And today we want to talk about how to, what an exemplary obstacle could be in practice. Let's, for example, talk about what in the C language actually happens. So, like this. So there is a feature in C that's called type definitions, where you can define a new type to use throughout the rest of your program, which is done with this particular typedef keyword, for, where you would be allowed to specify a certain type declaration afterwards. And in this type declaration, you would then use an identifier at the place where you would normally declare a new variable name, a new identifier, as having that particular type. However, if you add the specific type definition keyword, you would, instead of introducing a new variable of that name, you would create an alias to the type that you have declared here under the name of the identifier that you used in the red part here. So that is how this whole system works. And from that point on, the identifier from the type declaration would type definition would then not act as an identifier anymore, but instead as a type name. That has certain uses throughout a C program. People enjoy to have abbreviations in the sense that they, for example, in complicated structs, they would like to strip away the struct keyword, for example, and just use a plain word so that it looks more like a basic type. Or you might also enjoy the uses of a type definition for more readable recursive declarations of types. So that's an example that you see over here. There's a version which shows you how the standard approach would be. Here, you would introduce a new structure named list, and in case you want to refer to a field of that thing of the same type, you would have to repeat the same thing. And of course, for head, which for the beginning of such a list, you would once again have to use this struct keyword, and you could do that in a more readable way by type defining a special word for exactly that type, and you could then elaborate on how this type looks like by using the newly introduced type word. Well, yeah, so that seemed to be reasonable at that time. However, this has certain implications on how the C standard is formalized. As time went by, people started to standardize the C standard, and one of the points that they were agreeing on was to introduce a grammar for that. And in there, the way that the handling of typedefs and types and all that is handled is actually, well, it's a larger, a rather longish grammar that I have only put kind of an abbreviated version of a fraction of the productions on there. So there's a concept of declarations, and declaration looks like there's several declaration specifiers and a declarator, whereas the declarator has, well, one of the possibilities that the declarator can be is the actual identifier that is declared in that declaration. And everything else is added as a declaration specifier. There's a certain hierarchy in there, but I've not bothered to use it here. Instead, I've enumerated all the versions here. And what you find there is, for example, all the basic types. There's void, character, there's even more characters there. Should probably have been an integer. And a thing that's called a type name, which looks rather unfamiliar as a keyword. So that must be some dynamic thing that is assembled throughout your input file. And there's other things like the type def as a keyword, for example. And how that thing works is that in case you find the type def as a declaration specifier in your current declaration, you switch over to a mode where you introduce a new type synonym instead of a new variable, and be kind of done. And from now on, you would have to treat each occurrence of the identifier that you found in the type def declaration not as an identifier anymore, but instead this thing would have to be returned by the lexicographic unit as a type name from now on. So based on the history of what you have seen so far from the file, you have to switch token classes for certain names that would otherwise have been identifiers. Well, can anybody imagine a situation where that goes wrong? Or where that is something not what you would not want? You would want to use or redeclare void, or did I? That's kind of predetermined by the grammar in that case, yeah. But that's, I think, not a thing that is meant to be valid in C in that case. However, you might see that as a downside of this proceeding. Yeah, you have certain names which you just cannot give to other types. Yeah, so there's taboos there. Yeah, it's more of a technical thing that I was trying to point to. And particularly what goes amiss is, for example, you've got practical problems in exactly that example here. Why is that? Well, in principle, what you would have to do is you would have to, in that example, you would go and find typedef being used as a declaration specifier. So you would switch over to the typedef mode. You would then realize that you have found an identifier at some point. You would have to continue reading because there might be something else, which I haven't mentioned, the declarators. There might be modifiers like a star or an array or some other things that might follow there. And you would, in the end, terminate with the semicolon. And in the fashion as, for example, an LR parser does, you would not end right there, but you would instead all the time have to interpret one character more or one token more in the input stream. As well, you have a look ahead into the future. So what you do is you read the thing from the next line, which is this point T again. So what does that mean? You would somehow take or trigger the detection of the next token, which would lead the lexer to start matching its patterns. And one of these patterns is, for example, the identifier pattern. However, after you've done that, and maybe the lexer has already found this point T and turn it into an identifier, you start interpreting what you have seen in there in this typedef declaration. And that would tell you to introduce this identifier as a new token class or as another token class than before. Namely, you would like to interpret that as a type name from now on. However, yeah, that's what the definition is. Afterwards, when you use this word for declaring other variables, you will go into the form where you have type name and then an identifier once again. yeah, you're already. Sorry? It's all identifiers in principle, but what you need to do is type names. There's even a reason for that, which I'll show you a few slides further. But yeah, that's what you would have to do. However, you already read something like this and maybe even performed a few decisions based on your look ahead, because that's what your canonical automaton does. And yeah, that potentially messes up your whole data structures in there. So, yeah. That's a problem for you at home once again. The point in time where this point T type is added to the tables of types is when the declaration is reduced, but that's when the parser state has already read the next look ahead token, which might already be too late to do an appropriate manipulation on your type name list. So you would return this thing as identifier, and what you would get then is you would get identifier over here. And although that this looks quite okay right now, it turns out later on that you run into a problem when you try to patch around a little bit. So what would be possible solutions to that that came into your mind at first? Well, there's, for example, the idea of trying to fix the look ahead inside of the parser. Well, thinking back that you have already performed a few decisions in your canonical automaton, maybe already based on that particular piece of information, trying to backtrack might be impossible due to side effects of the code that you have executed right there. And that's exactly what you have done. You have kind of already patched certain data structures, like the list of type names, although that was the whole point. But in principle, what you would have to do there is to find some way of backtracking without negative effects, which might prove quite difficult for you. Another idea would be to skip this whole special treatment of type names, and everywhere where you expect a type name, you would instead expect an identifier. And you could simply do that by adding another rule to the grammar. However, if you do that, it turns out that you get a highly ambiguous grammar at that point, because there's actually several locations that already look like having two identifiers after each other, or even special cases where there's a little bit of other tokens involved, but in the end turn out to be ambiguous if you get rid of the type names as a special terminal token already. So yeah, that's for once offering you a lot of shift reduce and reduce conflicts, and most of them, well, you get away with some of them, but there are a few that are simply due to ambiguous grammars, and yeah, that's not what you want. So the actual idea of what you do is you need to somehow register the type name earlier. So that's a kind of a hack. I've always told you that what you do is, in case that you have recognized the complete right-hand side of a production, you would then have some kind of action code. What you instead can do in practical systems is that you can insert certain positions within the symbols of the in the sequence of the symbols of the right hand side, where you can put a special action in there, a special callback code. So, for example, what you can put in there is the registering being done one token before the semicolon, so that the semicolon will be the one that will be in your look ahead, which makes sure that the thing that comes in the next line is not read in. So, yeah, that's kind of your way around the whole problem. But yeah, you see, such a simple problem as type synonyms for C already introduces a lot of problems for you. Yeah.
I have a question. Would it be possible to just use TypeDef as a macro so it is pre-processed?
Yeah, the thing is, TypeDef is scoped. So if you do a preprocessor, you would have to use a very elaborate one that already recognizes the scoping rule for TypeDef. I'm actually not so familiar with all the flavors of preprocessors. Maybe there are a few around which do these scoping things, but I think in general the preprocessors are just pure text rewriting systems, and I would think that they won't do that, but I've not tried that way. Okay. Also, yeah, pretty much like that. Good. So, let's move on to the next topic related to types, and that is now that we have a type for each of our variables attached via link to its declaration. We might now go on to do type checking. The last thing before doing actual code generation. So, what is absolutely necessary before you can go on with code generation. So, there's this concept of a type that is attached to each of the variables and expressions. That is something you might already know or have guessed, as we have already talked about declarations. There are certain uses for types. For example, you would like to somehow manage memory in an efficient way. So that's why having type information is probably a good thing. Also, types are talking about subsets of the value set of a certain variable. And with that, you can already avoid a lot of runtime errors if the compiler already realizes that there are situations that just don't fit together, which will never work or lead into undefined situations. And that's why you would like to do type checking here. So the basic principle is that in languages that we focus on here, you always have the situation that you get pre-given the type of some basic things like the variables in form of declarations. So the user has to actually specify the type for the basic blocks in turn in the context of typing, and the compiler then performs a check whether these basic blocks are actually used within the right context where they fit together in that manner. And yeah, for that, you see these types that you already have constructed in these type declarations as a programmer as expressions over types, where you have certain constants, and the constants are these so-called base types. Base types are things like int, character, double, void, or whatever you float, obviously. All these things that are just a few bytes, and all of them are in a kind of uniform way. Yeah, and then there's this other concept of more complex data types, which are created via type constructors. And these type constructors are things that can be applied to other types. So that's kind of a recursive thing going on there. However, as you can't have something recursive, at least in these languages that we see, we will in the end at some point end in base types in this. So, yeah, examples for these type constructors in our theorist C language is, well, what do we have? We have, for example, structures. We introduce them with a keyword struct, and then we refer to other types in the types of the struct's fields, and also we specify these accessors, A1 to AK, each for each field of the struct. Another type constructor is, for example, the pointer. So you can introduce a pointer type with just this star symbol there. You can also introduce as type the array. There is dialects in C where you can even specify the size of this array in the type. If you do so, yeah, well, we have to give the size in within the brackets. Then there's the last complex type that we look at for our C purposes is the function. Here you have several references again to types. There's a return type, and there's types for each of the parameter, like that. Okay, so what does type checking actually mean? You're given a set of type declarations or mappings from variable names to types that are valid for your particular location in the source code. And the question now is whether a certain expression that is built up from the identifiers from the type declarations, whether this expression conforms to a certain type, or type-related questions where you would ask whether the type that you have is in some kind of subtype relation to a given type or something. So all of these involve that you need to find out about the type of a certain expression at that location. For example, you might be given the type declarations from here, which look quite complicated, with nested structs and functions and arrays in there, and you would somehow be interested in the type of, for example, that expression over here in the context of these type declarations that you have above. So I don't know how about you, but I can't actually say directly from just having this expression here what the actual type will be. However, all of us have a certain way of reading that, and that might be something that is translatable into an algorithm. So let's think about what we would actually would do. So what we would do is kind of divide and conquer. We would start at those little fragments for which we can clearly say what types are, which is the leaves in the syntax tree of such an expression. And what we would do is we would traverse the tree from the bottom to the top, like this. And if we start at an identifier, we have to perform a lookup in the current declarations list, the current types, or if we happen to meet a constant. Is it? Well, I'm not actually sure where that should be. Yeah, in this case, yeah, that's a bad example here. That's not a variable here, but that's an accessor. So let me remove that. So for this one over here, That's just a numeric constant, and each of those has a fixed type, a predetermined type that comes with them, and most of them are just due to their lexical pattern and are given by the scanner already. So you can just tell by the pattern what type that has. And that's the input into the whole thing. And then what you do is you go up from these leaves, and passing each of the inner nodes, you deduce types for the particular subtree's root, depending on the types of the children. So it's a clear bottom up tree traversal. And yeah, thinking back at what we had to do for declaration use analysis, where we would actually transport the information of types to each of the identifiers, what we had there was an L-attributed grammar and attribute grammar. So for that, we kind of already are inside a tree traversal depth first. In an L attribute grammar, what we need to do is we need to go down and then to the right. So there's when we are at a certain node and have to trigger the action for the bottom up traversal, we have already done everything that's necessary for the declaration use analysis if we merge these in the same run. So what we can do is we can do this type checking interleaved with the actual declaration use analysis. And that's what happens in many practical examples. You get a kind of a mixed analysis where you perform your declaration use analysis with this stack of symbol tables. And when you go back up from your depth first search, you perform type checking for the parts of the trees that you're leaving on the way back up. So that would be the interleaved version of this whole thing. Okay, so I was mentioning something like type rules. So what you establish for that system to work is a pool of axioms and rules that you're gonna use in order to deduce the types for your inner nodes. So the axioms are the things that you trigger when you have to provide the type for a leaf, and it's gonna be there is in case you have a constant the leaf for a constant in such an expression, you just take the type for that specific constant. That's something that you can just match with patterns. And in case you have to provide the type for just a variable, you can just look that up in your current type environment, which you get from this declaration use analysis. So that's simple lookup, and you already have the type for that. Then, in case you go through rules, in case you go through the inner nodes, you will have to deduce the types for these sub-expressions with the use of rules. And these give you the type for your current node, depending on the types of their children. So here we have examples for these rules for the reference and the dereference operator. So the type for the reference operator can be determined by, you have to first of all look up the type of your child, which is just this E thing. This is deduced in the step beforehand, so you can just get it from your child and get a T, and the resulting type for your current subtrees root is then the type denoted with that. So it's just adding kind of a points to wrapper around this. Then for a dereferentiation, like this, what you'll do is you will obtain the type for your child, E, and you expect it to be in the shape of that. You expect it to be already a kind of a pointer type, and in case it actually is, and your current expression is this dereferentiation, you then take the T as your new type for that subtree or sub-expression. So what's when the case is that I don't have a pointer type here? Sorry? Have you ever gotten your compiler to get stuck? Mm-hmm. Have you ever gotten your compiler to get stuck?
Basically, it would then generate an error message. But if you go formally, the rules get stuck.
Yeah, but that would actually result then in a type error. And you can explicitly say what the type error is by pointing at that particular position in your sub expression and tell about, well, expected a pointer type there, but found this and that. And that would be the thing. Yeah. But in general, yeah, you get kind of stuck. Okay, good. So there's even more typing expressions for that. There's the thing about arrays. So looking at arrays, you have two children of such an expression. So come on. You've got an expression E1 and E2. And yeah, what do you have to get here? Well, you have that E1 needs to be some kind of pointer type, and E2 needs to be an integer. And if so, then the resulting type is just a T. Okay. Good. So, that's not the only thing that you can get. There's also another rule for the array where you have, once again, E1 and E2, two children, and you can do the same thing with E1 as being an array type and E2 as an integer. So, yeah, that's kind of inherited from very early versions from C, so pointers and arrays are actually not that very different in that respect. You can use them both in these expressions. There's even more in practical systems. Can you mention other rules that might be valid there for arrays? No hardcore C programmers around? Well, yeah, that's exactly the case. So you can switch around the types for E1 and E2. So that's also perfectly valid. You would add another rule for that if you would like to support something like that. Good. Then structs. What's the thing with structs? Well, there's always this form over here. For struct accesses, you have e.ai. So there's an expression that serves as the point or the identity. Well, basically a struct type, and then there's another thing which then serves as the accessor within that struct. And yeah, turns out that for that to be a valid thing to also evaluating to a certain type, what you need is for E to actually be a struct, and within its lists of fields, you want to have the AI being one of them. So I haven't directly took it in there, but yeah, what you have to have is that the declaration of the struct for E actually features a field that is actually named AI. So otherwise that wouldn't be an accessor, and the resulting type for that, this had to happen at some point, that TI over here would then be the type for that particular accessor or field. Okay, what else do we have? We have function application from the point of view of expressions. What you have is that thing. There's expressions for the actual function pointer, and then there's expressions for the parameters. And the rules are that, well, E must be a function type, and E1 to EM, all the actual parameters of that thing, need to have a type which actually matches the type that belongs to the position of that particular parameter in the parameter types list of the function type. If that is the case, then the type of the function itself is then the type for the expression that you found. Okay. Good. Then there's certain operators. And, well, it's just an excerpt. It's not all the operators out there. There's operators with more complicated semantics, but one of the possible operators is the addition. So we have an expression, a binary expression with an operator, and it's expression 1 plus expression 2. So in short, it's pretty easy. If E1 is an integer and E2 is an integer, then the whole thing is constantly an integer. Yeah, and you have to add them for all of the operators. Good. Then there's the explicit cast, which is working like this, where you have not only a child expression, but as the second parameter, you have an actual type, this T2. And yeah, how does that work? Well, what actually happens is you look up the expression, get a type from there, T1, and in case that T1, and I have free text here, can be converted to T2, then T2 is the actual return type here. And right now, with what we have set up so far, we cannot really express this property, T1 can be converted to T2, any better, but we'll see what that actually means in a few slides, I guess. So, any questions to these typing rules?
Yes. What about type correction?
Mm-hmm. So right now, the system that we have here is just working on precise typing. So you need to actually manually perform any conversion between types if you desire to have something like that. So there is a notion of can be converted that we haven't talked about too much right now, and you have to use that in case that you somehow want to bridge the gap between one type or the other. So in that framework, there's nothing like type coercion in there. But of course, in practical systems, there is a notion of that, and we'll come to that. Mm-hmm. So for now, with the rules that we have so far, it's already quite nice to have a short example and see how they are working out for our example. So we have the expression over here, and our previous phases of the compiler already give us the parse tree of that thing in this form over here. So that's what we already get from the parser. And what we also get is the next phase, the semantic analysis has already begun, and what we already have so far is the declaration use information. That means that we have a type environment gamma available for use at these at the evaluation of the types of that expression, so we can use these this information for type checking. So maybe let's just try that together. So with our principles, how would you start?
With two.
Okay, so why with two?
With the rules we have, we can deduce that the result of the plus operation, because we have two, should be int.
So, well, that is probably the first step that I gave you away right now. The thing is, kind of the easiest thing where you can absolutely be sure that everything works out is the leaves. There's nothing going in there. You can just take them and put the types there. So in our world, two is always an int, so we don't have anything like bytes or characters or something to go around these things like coercion. So 2 would be an int right here. And you would want to go the next step already and go to plus and determine that. Remember, or thinking back at the rule that we introduced for plus, we only have one instance of that, and that's always giving us plus. However, I would like to not do that right now, because there's still another child over here which somehow needs to give us the precondition for that. We can only say that the whole thing evaluates to integer in case that both of the children in there have the type of integer. And for that, we can't say right now. So that would be why we can't simply start at an arbitrary point, but we would have to do this top-down exactly not the top-down approach, but the bottom-up approach. So what we would need instead is we would have to treat all the other leaves in that first, and then only when all the children have types available, we would then do the do the determining of the or do the type checking for the inner nodes. So, first of all, well, let's say we already have now the type for int. That's a leaf. That's fine. So maybe you want to do the next.
Sorry, I can't, because I didn't pay attention to the last one.
Okay, so maybe let's try with A. Can you imagine any type for that? So I do start at leaf, so we have a leaf here, that's fine. And
yeah,
we can directly look it up in the type environment if it's just a plain name. So that would be the type for A. There is an A in there, it's a little bit hidden. That's over here. Yeah, it's C-ting syntax all over, yeah. But we can just write it down, well, like it is defined. So it's an int pointer array.
Okay.
So, what's actually binding more? Is it an array of pointers, or is it a pointer of arrays? Any comments?
Array of pointers.
Everyone agrees? Okay. Well, probably this one gives it away, but anyway, yeah, it's a pointer of arrays. Yeah, well, the arrays bind more than the pointer in that sense. Okay, but that shouldn't keep us in our type representation. We wouldn't get that as a flat declaration, but we would already get that try to create an object representation that fits our purposes, in the sense that we put the thing that binds more directly next to the inner element and the other things around. But that's kind of a practical issue of designing your compiler. There's binding rules for that, and they are actually encoded in the grammar rules for C. So it doesn't actually really matter whether we know about them. It's encoded in the grammar anyway, and we can just create our types in the way that we need them with that. Anyway, maybe next thing, F, what would you propose for this one? Yeah, it's just reading once again, I guess. Yeah, so F was probably quite appropriate to use. Yeah, it's a function. Nice.
So a function that takes a struct as input.
Mm-hmm. Struct. Yeah, list is a part of this thing, and it's also a pointer to that. Mm-hmm. And what else? There's still the return, exactly. Okay, yeah, and then, well, I guess now it's pointless. You already know what to do here. You just have to look up the next name. It's B, and what would that be now? That would be, the struct. It's an anonymous struct, thus I have to just add the name, struct list pointer, like that. Okay, so that's the thing, the leaves for which we now have the types. Now it's about inferring the types for the actual inner nodes. Well, we should probably start with the inner node that has all its types given already. So that would be this one here. So that's the bottom-up way. No. That's not the one that has given anything. That one. Type for this one? Dereferentiation takes away one pointer level from the type. So you take the children, the child in this case, and have struct of, yeah. Struct list pointer under the name of C, and that's it. Good. Nobody can read that, I'm sure, but you have plain things above in the type environment. So the next one where all of them are given is this accessor operator. And the accessor operator is a little bit special in that its first parameter is, of course, an expression and has a certain type. The second parameter, though, is not interpreted as a variable or something, but instead is interpreted as an accessor and has to be somehow matched with the available fields in the type of the first parameter of the thing. So what we need to do here is, well, we take the first child and have this very good readable type over here. And the thing is, it needs to be, first of all, it needs to be a struct. Well, that's for sure. That's a struct. Fine. Next thing is we need to look for the accessor that is given by this parameter here. And it's a C, and oh, happy day, we have a accessor or a field named C here. How very lucky. And the thing is, the return type for this is now given by the type of the actual field that matches our accessor. So the type for that is now struct list pointer. Okay, we can continue with the next one. This thing here. Yeah, for that we need, once again, two parameters. They are rather standard now. We have the, well, you could also have more than just two children, by the way, but in our case, the one thing is this function application needs to match the number of its parameters with the number of parameters that are required by the definition of the very leftmost child. Left child. And yeah, that's given by this thing here, and this guy seems to have one particular parameter, so we're quite fine with just having another child. That's this one here. And now we have to match up the type of the parameter of the function type from the left child, this one here, with the type of its right neighbor, which is this one here, and oh, very well. There's no type error here. We have the exact type here. And now the return type for that is, well, the thing that can be found here. So that is now of type int. Yeah. And let's continue just with that. You have to evaluate the type for this one, or check the type for this one. Yeah, array access, we have to check for the left child and its type, and it needs to be arranged in that way that the thing that matches is now the array. So that is, if that is now the pointer of arrays, then we are probably fine. And the second thing needs to be an integer for the whole thing to work. That's done with that. It needs to be an index, a numerical value. It might also be the other way around, but in our case, we're completely fine with an array type and an integer. And with that, we can then give the whole thing its base type. So it's int star. We can dereference that and that part, so we get an integer. And now now we have integer and integer as parameter, so the preconditions are met, and we can infer that the whole thing will evaluate to an integer. Yeah, I could have gone a little bit more easy by just typing return. So, did we do everything right? I think it seems so. Good. So, that's how the whole system would run, and that's kind of the addition that you would have to add to your visitor in order to do this type checking. So fine, so good. all in all, this type checking is something where the type of the actual node is depending on the children. We have seen that, and we somehow need to determine we need a concept for whether types are equal to some other type for the whole system to work. C is pretty useful for that because it helps us as from the point of view of the type checker quite a lot in that, for example, these things here, struct A and struct B, although they are in its usage, for example, completely similar, they are considered to be different beasts. So struct A is from a different type than struct B. That makes it pretty easy to talk about the equality of such types in C, as you just have to actually compare the actual denominator for this type, the name for this struct, and that's all that is done in C. You might argue, well, there is something like different names for types in C. It's not always exactly the same name. Yes, that's true, but only for these type def things. So a type def in C will actually create an alias of types, and that's the only thing where you can't actually go by just the name. So that's the only difficulty in this whole system, if you take away things like coercion, but yeah, more for that later on. There's other concepts for type systems. For example, there's type systems which feature something like structural type equality. This is a little bit, this is another concept of the equality of types with a focus on the structs, and it was created with the intention to capture more of the intention of two types being equal by comparing how they can be used in the sense that you can consider two types as equal if all the access paths that you can use on these types turn out to in the end evaluate to the same type. So regardless of what you give as a name for a certain structure, in structural type equality you would consider the type as being equal if all possible paths that you can use for access turn out to evaluate to in a similar way. What would that mean in an example? Of course, there's the easy examples where you just have different names but the same definitions, but these are the boring ones. There's also other ones which fall under this category, and that is the example from over here. So that is the version of the linked list that you would probably create intuitively. And there's an alternative, which is in terms of accessors giving you the same types, which is the one over here, where you have once again a list implementation like this, where if you access info, you also get an integer back. You can also access next, and what you get from there is a structure, same as with accessing this next, or, well, you get pointer to a structure, but that's for both of them. And, of course, they are not the same as, well, they have, well, in this case, they don't have, do they have names? Yeah, they have the name list over here, and this one is kind of anonymous. So, they're sort of different. However, in the or at least in the conventional C meaning, However, here in structural type ecology, we don't care about the actual name of this thing, but in its access structures. So if you do an accessor of info on the struct that that comes out of this next, you will get an integer via this info. And, well, in the thing that comes through this accessor next, you will also have an integer under the name of info. And you can do your recursion on this next thing again and again and again. And in the end, it turns out that all the finite accesses that you can do there always return things that are the same, and from the perspective of types at least, and thus you would consider those as being equal. Sure. However, that is something that's not strictly valid in C, but there's other languages where that is actually a thing. There's also a version of that which is not talking about all possible access paths, but all access paths that are gone in during the runtime of a program, and that's a thing that you would call duck typing. Don't know, has anyone heard that word before? So at least a few people. So if you try to perform access to a certain field of the thing and it happens to exist, then everything's fine, and you would consider that as a valid pointer to a type of your desire. And yeah, the name comes from the proverb that you treat something as a duck as soon as it just quacks if you poke it. So anything that you poke that quacks will be just a duck. So that was the analogy for that. And this poking is kind of the, just trying to get the right result. And if it then gives the right result, it's already completely usable for us, and we treat it as that thing. So, yeah. But here, the structural type equality on this, in the sense of static analysis is this property extended to all paths that can possibly be taken, and not just the ones that are actually taken in practice. So it's a little bit of a more strict notion than the duck typing. And for that, it's a little bit challenging to actually really say whether things have structural equality or not. So it might be interesting to just see the algorithm for that. And the idea for that is to track the possible queries on the types in question and see what actually comes back there. And if types are actually then syntactically equal, we can stop and report success for that type of queries. And all the other queries that are possible, we then have still have to pursue. And with that, we hope to actually reduce the amount or the size of the type that we have we still have to query with that. Let's see how that works out. We assume that if we do something like recursive types, we do that with type def of type A being accessed with T. And yeah, we just skipped talking about type environments. Let's have a look at what the rules for well-typedness in such an environment would actually be. So we would set up rules as kind of subtrees that we can, or templates for trees that we can then try to plug together to get a kind of to get a tree of derivations of types, and we can always plug them together if the types have the correct pattern, so to say. So there's the terminating subtree. We would create such a thing when two types T and T would be actually syntactically the same. So we would create such a terminator for int int, for double double, for character character, and all the types that we actually have. And this thing just tells us that, yay, success, here we have found a well-typed branch of our tree. Then what else is there as kind of basic block for our trees, for our deduction trees? There's, for example, this one here, where we would have two types, no matter what the actual base type is. The highest level type modifier in this is in both sides this pointer addition, and we can reduce the question of well-typedness from the S star T star types to the types S and T. So these are well-typed if these are. Then what we also could match is if we have a type synonym A there, and we have to match it with a type T, we would instead match the original type. Yeah, I think I might have gotten the names the wrong way around, but I'll correct that in the original. Anyway, apart from that, we now need a notion of comparing the complex types like structs. And for that, what we would do is we would, given two structs, we would compare each of the accessors of them, so A1 to AM, and we would require that each of the types S1, T1 for the accessor A1 and SM, TM for the accessor AM would actually be matching. And with that, we can now try to do such a structural type matching. So, turns out, it's just here that I got the type defs wrong, so here they are already once again corrected. So, we could ask ourselves now whether these types are actually the same, and for that we would then construct the deduction tree, which would look exactly this way. There's this twofold node, and we would have to follow our deduction rules that we have introduced as these basic blocks of these trees on the page before. And first thing would be probably, I don't know whether I have this stepwise. No, it's not. Okay. You get all these things already applied over here. So the first thing would be to take this thing and replace it with its actual type definition to come to that thing over here. And now we are comparing two types on the level of structure definitions over here. So for that, we have learned we have to take a look at all the accessors after each other. So there's the info accessor and the next accessor. And the info will give us on the left side an int, on the right side also an int, and int int, you've seen there's the terminator for int int that gives us yes, succeed. So this branch is already terminated and says types are matching. For this thing, for the next part, we get a quite longish type like this. Haven't written that out. And over here, just a pointer. And that's dereferentiation. So we'll just remove the pointer. So we get A and now this longish type. Once again, like already above here, we will replace the type definition with its actual type. So instead of A, we will get this one. And now we have to once again structure comparison. So this means we have to compare, we have to compare accessor-wise. So you have to compare for info. Info is int and int over here, and that's fine. And then we have next. Evaluates to A pointer and B pointer, like this. So we get these. It's always pointers, so we have to replace them. We can just remove them in dereferentiation, get this one. And that's now the point where we come to yet another structure. But the thing is, we do that for a purpose. We do that this replacing until we reach a point where we already have found a derivation tree 4 or deduction tree 4. And looking closer, you'll see that this is exactly the same tuple as we already had before. So we haven't met any thing that speaks against equality, but we have found that the whole thing is depending on these types recursively being considered as semantically equivalent, and with everything else we cannot create something that goes wrong. So in the end, we can say by recursion this whole thing is just be considered as the same. So the implementation for this check is the way that if no deduction rule can be applied, then there's an error. These two types are considered as not being equal. Then the other thing is that if we encounter such a tuple of types that we already have seen somewhere above in the tree, we can just stop at that position. We don't have to evaluate further, but we can say the equality comparison for that is already done by the pairing somewhere closer to the root, and consider this to be fine, and go further to try to construct some disequalities in a branch further to the right. And if we don't happen to encounter any, we'll hope in the end that the whole system terminates. And that's actually a crucial point in our thing, to actually get an algorithm out of that. But the thing is that from all the definitions that you have in there, you will only get a finite set of declared types that can be used in your type expressions. And although the types might grow larger, they will never be necessary to be to become larger than the original by any means, because we just can just deconstruct our types. We can never create newer things in there. So what we do there is we if the trees that we build up from there, if we say that in case we hit a pairing that we already had before, all that we can find in our tree is different pairs of types, and you can imagine this just finitely many possibilities to create pairings out of the types that we have. So we get only d square many different equivalence queries possible in our tree. So the ones that are repeated, we consider to be satisfied automatically. So if we only have a finite number of queries for equivalence and only finitely many types, then in the end, at some point I must have either found disequality, or I will have terminated all my branches with either matching or a repetition, and that means our algorithm terminates in the end. Finally, there's the thing that you have been asking for so long. There's the notion that their types are not always unique in the sense that types can be subtypes of others. And that's complicating matters a little bit. For example, take the addition operator. Even the implementation of the actual operator on the machine needs to be different depending on the type that the parameters actually have. If you have integers as parameter, for example, you will have to provide an integer as a result. Same goes for floats. You have to provide a float as result. And you can't just recycle the same implementation for that because there's floating point has another format as an integer, and you have to support that. There's also things that you might not have thought of before. There's in C, for example, you can do something like adding an integer to a pointer, and for that you also need to have special support because you need to modify the pointer in a certain way depending on the actual width of the data that is pointed to. So that is also special implementation, and it needs to return a pointer and not an integer in that case. So these are all specialized implementations of an operator that looked quite ordinary in the first place. And it all depends on the type of the parameters that are used, the type of the arguments, as said, like here. The other thing that you have to consider is the thing of, well, if you allow such a thing, you might also not want to provide implementations to all the possible combinations of types, especially as there's these subtype things. But instead, what C, for example, does is that it coerces types into other types in case that that is needed in the context. What does it mean? That does mean that if you, for example, use or find an expression like this in your source code where you have 5 plus dot 5, there's different types used, but you might only have implementations for this and this version of the addition operator. In that case, you would have to somehow modify your view on the current data in some way. And in our way, that would be considering that float is somehow capable of representing integers. It would be considered as being kind of the more general type of the two, and the idea in these kinds of expression is to try to coerce the more specialized type in the more general type. Maybe you have to convert for that, and for this float and integer usage, for example, you would have to actually do something about that, and yeah, make both of the arguments to be of the more general type, and then perform the instance of the addition for the more general type. Okay. Subtypes, you can not only interpret on the basic types, but you can also get a notion of subtypes on the complex types. So let's talk a little bit about what a generalized understanding of subtypes would actually mean. So for one type being a subtype of another, we would use an comparison operator like that. And this would mean that T1 is kind of the subtype of T2. We use this smaller than or equal comparator like this because you can kind of memorize the whole thing by T1 being a subtype of TB if there is if speaking of types as the set of all the values that variables of that type can actually evaluate to, the types of T1 as the subtype of T2 would be a subset of the more general type. The values would be a subset of the values of the more general type. So if you count all the values that meet the constraints for the subtype, and the values that meet the constraints for the supertype, then you would have one being the ones from the subtype being clearly less than the ones from the supertype, and also all of the values that you see in the subtype are kind of in the set for the supertype. This also means that if you encounter a value of the subtype, you can they fulfill all the requirements to be used as the supertype. You can assign a value from a subtype to a variable of a supertype, and if might necessary, you might also convert or be able to convert from that direction to the other without too much loss in the semantics. So that is what subtypes should be interpreted from. For example, that is used for this fixed term of assignability. That is a term that you will encounter quite a lot if you read specifications for these C-like languages. For example, in the Java specification, .NET specification, in the C specification, C++ specification, you get always a notion of is assignable to, or written in one word as being a property of two types, and that is exactly what this subtype hierarchy is all around. And there's always, if it's when it's about type checking, you get this this concept of assignability. So yeah, and it's always the case that you assign the smaller type or the subtype to the larger type. So for example, in our case, you could assign int to double. And maybe let's skip the example over here. This has certain impact on the way that we do our type deduction. For once, it's the case now that we don't. Formally we just introduced the successful matching of types when both of the types were actually matching. Now what we do is, if we have with T and T prime, if we have basic types, then we say success if the basic type T is a subtype of the basic type T prime. If our query is the left a subtype of the right. And that's the kind of queries that we want to set up here. Apart from that, the deduction rules for the other operators in that line are not different. So for dereferentiation, everything is still the same. There's once again confusion going on here. But for type synonyms, it still remains the same. Now, for structures, speaking about structural equality or concept of structural equality, now we can do a little bit more here. If we can consider a struct like here from the left side in green as being a subtype of the struct of the right-hand side, if we have structural concept of equality, if for all the accessors of the supertype, so all the accessors that we find here in this thing, we find field names in the type specification of the left struct, maybe more, but that is not something that bothers us. And what we require is that all the types that we find for these accessors are again subtypes of the types from the original struct. So the S types are always The S types are always subtypes, or always have to be subtypes of the T types. T types being there and S types being why not? That's why. Being there. This means that just a moment. This means that situations like these situations like these would be valid in structural typing. You could introduce an X here and a Y there, and you could assign this X to the Y, and actually both of these structs don't have to be exactly matching, but the type X must be a subtype of the type for Y. That's why. And if you look closer in there, the type for X is actually the same as the type for Y, but it's just extended with one thing. So it's considered to be a subtype, and this accessor V would correspond to an additional field in there, which wasn't present at the struct of the supertype, but we said, well, we don't actually care. This is a subtype. This is an extension. It still works for all the accessors that are possible for its supertype, so we're fine with that. Okay, you had a question. These things, they don't need to be in the same sequence. But the thing is that you, for all of the for the accessors that you find here, all of them, you need to draw a subtree there.
But I mean, in the first like subtree, you would have S J one T one.
Yeah.
The accessor of S J one is A J one.
Oh, get me. that would I can't really do it like that. I can't really write the SJ1 here. I would have to match them according to the
accessors.
To the accessors. Yeah. So sorry for confusing you there. Yeah. Of course. Sorry. That wasn't meant to confuse you. I have to correct that. Yeah. You're right. Good thinking. So. That's probably, yeah, good. So I might switch around the indices a little bit more in the next revision of the slides. Yes, please?
You know something like that, but it's a bit tricky to compile, right? You can't just say, okay, I struct my point and then I go back on set because it might be super tight or something. How do you handle that?
Well, you could, for example, not do it with an offset, but with a translation table of names, for example. That's already pretty close to the idea of how subtyping works with classes in the Java playground, where you have only names as and not offsets into files anymore. And you might be able to random optimize that into something that actually performs. Okay. Good. So last time we didn't do the rule for application of a function. Because that was just plainly going through, matching the types of the parameters with each other, as well as the type of the return thing. Here, with subtyping now, and structural subtyping, to be more precise, it's a little bit more complex, because for application of functions, it's a little bit more tricky. If you just have a look at the return type, everything looks fine. We have as the function S0 is a subtype of the function T0. For example, if the return values are also subtypes of each other, so far so good. However, if you look at the types for the parameters, you might act a little bit surprised. It's actually the other way around. You have to interpret S0 or the function, well, let's call it F and G. You have to if the function F is a function is considered a subtype of the function G. It's only then when the parameters of function T are actually subtypes of the parameters of function F. So it's completely the other way around. We're running low of time a little bit, so I have to maybe highlight that directly for you and not let you guess. So, for example, the function of return type float and parameter type float is actually not a supertype of the function int. Instead, they have to somehow revert. So the function int with return type int and parameter flow is actually a subtype of the function of return type float and parameter type int. You can subtype by specializing, thus decreasing the number of possible. You can subtype by increasing the number of possible parameter values. So the function is still able to act as a function that gets less parameters. But what you have to keep in mind is that for the return value of the specialized function, you never exceed the number of parameters that you can give back as a return value. So you need to be at least the same type as the thing that you are specializing, or even more narrow. So that's why the int is there instead of the float. So that is the idea of subtyping on the level of function types. And yeah, you have even special words for this. For this behavior, and it's what you have there is the covariance of the return types. That means that the types of the return types are acting similar to what the complete type is behaving like. So if your complete types are subtypes, then also your return types are in collaboration with that in the same relation. However, the types of the, or the relations between the parameter types are actually the complete way around. So it's contravariance here. They are acting the other way around as the complete types subtype relation is. So that's contravariance for you. Okay, and we have hopefully a little bit time left for the examples here, because I think then we can stop with subtyping matters. So we have a few declarations of types there, always now with structs and functions types, and we might be interested in whether S1 is a subtype of R1. So we set up our tableau here once again with S1 and R1. And S1 is struct as well as R1, so we have to compare the accessors. So we have accessor A. Accessor A in both evaluates to int. That's fine. That one is subtype of, or it's not a supertype. So it's less equal. That's why equal is also okay. Int is a subtype of int, so to say. Then there's the accessor for f. That would be this one and this one. And that gives us S1 parameter of with a parameter of S1 compared to R1 with a parameter of R1. And for that to work, we have to compare for once the return values, which gives us S1 needs to be a subtype of R1. That's fine. We've seen that over there. So we can terminate. That's this recurring occurrence of an earlier query. But then we get our problem, which is this one here. R1 needs to be a subtype of S1. Well, that is completely the opposite of the thing that we are querying right now. So the S1 being a subtype of R1 depends on the property that R1 is a subtype of S1. And that is something that we cannot deliver with that. So, yeah, that's a contradiction in our case. Another example. We are interested in S1, S2 being a subtype of S1. That's why we ask for this one here. The accessors A and B need to be queried because they are in the second thing, so A and B. S2, S1, yeah, so we find both of them in there. Both of them go to int, and that's fine. Apart from that, we have in S1 still an F. That's what we also find in S2, so we can go this one and get both of the signatures, S2, S1, S1, and S2, R2, S2, R2, and S1, S1. For that, we need to compare covariantly the return types, S2 and S1, which gives us this one again. Fine. Then there's this one over here, for which we, well, that's once again structs. So we go the accessor A. Accessor A gives us S1 R2. S1 R2 gives us both times int. That's fine. Then S1 R2. Yeah, R2 is the one which... So B doesn't matter. R2 doesn't have a B, so S1, S1's B is fine no matter what. We still have the F to compare, so we compare S1, S1, and R2, S2. Once again, we have the covariant return types, contravariant parameter types. S1, R2 is something that we have already gotten here. S2, S1 is something we've already gotten here, and we're done. So there's no failure in that. So we can look at the next one, and yeah, well, same proceeding here, I would say, S2, R1, S2, R1, so we have to go through A, which is here, and has integer, this one, R2, sorry, F is the second one from here, so we have to go F, which is R1, R1, and over here it is S2, R2, covariant return types gives us that, which we already have over here. For the parameters, we are contravariant, so we have R1 and R2 going like this, of the cross, R1, R2, we compare those with each other. We have R2 gives us the accessor A, which is evaluating to int, fine. We have the accessor B in R1 and R2, well, accessor F, sorry, in R2, which is the important one. This is also in R1, gives us the two method signatures. We have R1, R1 like this, R2, S2 like this. Covariant Return types give us R1, R2. Contravariant parameter types give us S2, R1, like this. R1, R2 is something we have already over here. S2, R1, like this, and we're done. That's the way how you do perform these checks. I think, I should let you go to tutorial because we're done with that already anyway. So that's all about types so far. We're going to do code synthesis next time. I hope you have no questions anymore. No? That's fine. Okay, so we'll see us next week. Goodbye.